On this podcast, we share a lot of stories, and often the mental health aspect of the work we do creeps in. If you think you might be feeling depressed, stressed, anxious, or even overwhelmed, please consider visiting our sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who are trained to listen and help you. And they even have therapists who specifically work with first responders. You just fill out a questionnaire to help assess your specific needs, and then you get matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. You can talk to your therapist in a private and online environment at your convenience. Many first responders work rotating and often odd schedules, so this format makes it really easy to talk to someone when it's convenient for you. If you don't click with your therapist, you can request a new one at no additional charge anytime. Join the 3 million plus people who have taken charge of their mental health with an experienced BetterHelp therapist. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/Rhody. That's betterhelp.com/Rhody, R-O-A-D-I-E. You can also find the link in the show notes.
You got to find a way to not really forget the memories, but know how to deal with them.
On the trolley side, just a little bit of fire lit.
A path, they clear a path. I say, holy cow, they made a path for us.
If you put a couple of first responders together in a room, something interesting happens. Before too long, they'll begin sharing stories. They're not trying to one-up each other, they're simply finding common ground. I was fortunate enough to serve my community as a paramedic and a firefighter for over 25 years. As you can imagine, during that time, I acquired my fair share of stories about the incidents and the calls I was involved in. I thought I might write a book, but then I decided sharing these stories collectively in a podcast would give anyone listening an insider's view into the work that first responders do every single day. These are the stories of the men and women who courageously serve the public. Or as I like to call them, Stories from the Road. Welcome back to Stories from the Road. I'm your host, Phil Klein, and joining me on the podcast today is Coordinator Mindy. And Mindy is a first for the podcast. We haven't had an emergency manager on here, so I'm really excited to hear what she has to talk about. Mindy's got 22 years of service, and not all of that service has been as an emergency manager. She also worked as a 911 director and also as a dispatcher, so quite a bit of experience. And I'll turn the mic over to you and let you share your story from the road.
Thank you. It's a little different for me being an emergency manager now. I do come from a law enforcement family. My dad has been retired for since 2019. So he was in law enforcement. He was the chief of police in a small town and was also a reserve deputy for the county we were in here in Iowa. And my mom was a bank teller. So I really wanted to be something in law enforcement or public safety when I was little. I used to run around the house with his radio on my hip ever since I was about 4 years old. So my parents knew I was destined to be something in public safety. Started my career as a 911 dispatcher with Cedar Rapids Police and Fire Department here in Iowa. Loved that job. I thought was pretty proficient at it. When I left, had a lot of people try to talk me out of it. I had a burnout. After about 10 years, I was burnt out, needed a break, really took calls, everything from, you know, the run-of-the-mill things as, you know, houses were broken into, the dogs barking next door, upwards of pretty high profile cases of kidnappings, homicides, rape, murders, you name it. So I was really feeling the effects of taking those calls. So decided to go private sector, and it was the worst 6 months of my life. I knew I needed to get back into public safety. So I started to work for another dispatch agency, which would be the Iowa State Patrol. Was there for about 3 years and thought, you know, I can do more. I can do better. So I applied for a small county here in Iowa, Tama County, and got hired there to be their 911 director and emergency manager. So it was definitely a twofold career. Ran a 911 center and also did emergency management on the side. They wanted me to focus more on 911, but once I got that up and going, then I switched gears to focus on emergency management. So that kind of led into working a lot of hours focusing on a lot of disasters once I got a great assistant by my side and knew that he could handle the 911 things. So I worked a lot of presidential disasters. We had two tornadoes and a record flood all within 1 year. During my 7 years there, we had, I believe it was at least 4 presidential disaster declarations. The last one being in August of 2020. It was the largest disaster I ever worked, was the derecho. It did not really make national news for as large as it was. Really was a really large storm that started out in the flats of Nebraska and then blew up into this just amazingly huge storm that started out in western Iowa. And as it hit like Carroll County, Iowa, and the Des Moines County area, Polk County, Iowa, it just blew up into this massive storm that had no one's ever seen anything like this in the history of Iowa. So by the time it hit the county where I was at, which was Tama County, the winds were at 100 miles an hour. And it just blew through the state of Iowa. And as it continued east, the winds kept increasing. So you were seeing 100 miles an hour, 120, 130 miles an hour. And the only thing that we were told anybody could equate it to was a hurricane, hurricane force winds. So we knew, I guess I'll back up a little bit, that day you could just tell the atmosphere felt different. It was just really, really different. We knew it was going to storm. About 20 minutes before the storm got to the communities where we were at, I got a call from the National Weather Service. They said, hey, there is a massive storm coming your way. They called it a particularly dangerous situation, or PDA. We don't ever get issued PDAs. They're very few and far between. So they called and said, this is coming your way. You need to do something to notify as many people in a short amount of time as you can. So just be prepared. We're looking at 86 mile an hour sustained winds for an extended period of time. It's coming. You need to do what you're going to do. So the office that I was in was not in the sheriff's office or where the dispatch center was. So I got a hold of, I joke now because I say I used our PA system and hollered down the hall is what our PA system was to our human resources director. And I said, will you help me contact the county offices, tell them to get their people inside, off the roads, because it's August. They're working on bridges, they're working on roads, they're working everywhere you can think of, and tell them to get to safety. This is coming towards us, and it's going to do significant damage. Because if you look, we're kind of centrally located in the state of Iowa. It's 722 square miles. There was 12 communities as well as an Indian settlement. So we had a lot of people. It's about 17,000 people. So it's good sized for the state of Iowa. And I called each of the 12 communities and said, if you have maintenance, if you have community events, you have swimming pools, close them now. And just as I got the last community called, the storm was knocking on our community door. It was there. So I looked out the door to would have been the south and the east, and it was just that green in color. And you could feel the temperature change. You could see all the birds like leaving. It was just, I'm getting goosebumps now just thinking about it.
Mindy, can I stop you for 1 second? You'll have to forgive my ignorance, but do you have, like Kansas, Nebraska, they have tornado sirens, they have ways to warn towns. Did your county have anything like that? Was it activated?
Yes. So we do have outdoor warning sirens, and our dispatch center only had the ability to set off 5 outdoor warning sirens. The rest of the communities, it was on the fire chiefs to set those up. The unfortunate part was I had talked to our 911 board about allowing for wind events to have for me to set those off during wind events. And that had kind of gotten vetoed by the 911 board saying, no, we really don't need to set those off for wind events. We just want to set those off for tornadoes. So I was really torn on, do I kind of beg for forgiveness after I set these off, or do I follow protocol and procedure? I was really fighting that internal battle. What do I do? And I'm like, you know, 86 mile an hour winds, that's a lot of damage. I know that I called everybody I could. I warned everybody I could. I will follow protocol and procedure and just pray to God that everybody's okay out of this. So again, I'm kind of standing in the doorway looking outside. It's a glass door, you know, doing what Midwesterners do. We stand in the doors and we watch these storms roll in. And again, everything's green. And we know is green is really an indication of tornadic events. So the wind picks up and it rips the door out of my hand and then kind of slams back on my chest. And I'm like, okay, this is not good. So I grab the door, close it, lock it. I run down the hall. I tell my coworker, our HR director, human resources director, I said, we need to shelter in place in this hallway. This is our safe because we don't have basement in that building. I could see the sheer panic in her eyes. She's like, what do we do? I said, we're fine. We're going to be okay. I didn't know if we were going to or not, but I said, we're going to be okay. I said, just close your office door. We'll stand right here in the hall. It's going to be okay. Well, our maintenance, county maintenance guy that takes care of the buildings, he comes in and he goes, this is going to be bad. And I said, it is. But I kind of looked him straight in the face and I looked at our human resources director. I said, we will be okay. As I'm looking at him, trying to make eye contact to let him know that our HR gal is really panicking now. And about that time, the wind hit at, I don't have a wind meter, unfortunately, but it sounded like the roof picked up off of our building and slammed back down. And I think it was just the wind hitting the building. And we were looking out and we could see sheets of corrugated steel flying across the street, hitting our building and then kept flying down the street. And that was one of the buildings across the street being destroyed. And we just saw debris and everything flying across the road. And it was sheets of rain and the sound. It was just a sound I've never heard before. And I hope in my lifetime I never hear it again. And the instant thought I had was, I hope we don't have catastrophic injuries. I hope we don't have any deaths because we are now on an island. People to the west of us are being hit by this. People to the east of us are going to be hit by this. To the south, to the north, they're all being hit by this. We are on our own. There are no more resources to be requested for law enforcement, fire, or EMS. We are alone. We don't have any, we didn't have any full-time fire departments. They're all volunteer in our county. We had, trying to think, it was very, very few full-time paramedics in the county. So there was five or six full-time paramedics in the county that worked primarily Monday through Friday. And they're going to be busy in their own communities because I don't know how bad the rest of the communities are being hit in our county. So I'm sitting there collectively thinking, if we have responders, how far are they coming from? How many hours is it going to take for them to get to us? Because I can guarantee power lines are down. All of the roads are impassable. Highway 30 is a major thoroughfare through Iowa. And then Highway 63 also bisected our county. So I'm like, if we have semis on any of those roads, they're going to be flipped over. So are we going to have hazardous material spills? Are we going to have livestock that are out? How many people are going to be injured and or killed in houses with trees collapsed on them? So I was mentally making those checklists. I'm like, I need to call Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management duty officer. So I was on the phone trying to call them, had no service, couldn't get through. And mind you, this is all during COVID. So August of 2020, COVID is in full force. So we still have protocols in place through the governor's office. We're still doling out PPE, people are wearing masks. So this is just one big, pardon my mouth, shit show. And how can it get any worse? How can it get any better? And this storm went on for 50 minutes. It just kept, the wind kept coming, the rain kept coming. It would not stop. And I'm thinking, how, we have no power. So the power immediately went out. I'm trying to get on the radio. I thought at that point in time, forget it, forget my protocols, forget my procedures. I'm going to tell the dispatch center to sound the sirens. Tried to get on the radio, had no radio signal. They never copied anything I said. After the fact, I heard that as soon as the storm hit, 911 calls started rolling in. So they had, I think it was an average of like 1.7 911 calls per second. So two dispatchers on at a time, they were just inundated with 911 calls. It was, to say the least, the most intense thing anyone has ever had happened in that county. And it was like that for at least the first 12 hours. So the first full cycle of incident command that we had happen. After everything, the storm was, it was still raining. Things were still transpiring. I finally had made it out to my truck to get to the fire stations, at least in Tame and Toledo. So if you figure, Tame and Toledo are both about 2,500 people, give or take. So about 5,000 people in both community. And they sit side by side with each other. Highway 30 splits both communities. I got to my vehicle to leave. It was still pouring down sheets of rain. I stopped at the first fire station I got to, which is in Toledo, Iowa. And the fire department was there. They were rolling out. I said, do you guys need anything? They're like, we have no idea. I said, okay, I'm on the radio. Call me if you do. And then I made it to the old Highway 30. And there's a Casey's gas station. And there was a truck and trailer blown over. The old, it used to be like an old service station or an old car lot. Their building had just collapsed and part of it was blown across the road. Highway 63 was just, I don't know how deep it was. You know, we tell people don't drive through flooded roads. I just went right through it. I did see a truck that was, the building had collapsed on top of the truck. I had tunnel vision and forgot to drive in there and check to see if there was anybody in the truck. The Casey's parking lot, again, had a livestock trailer flipped over. There's people tending to that. And I just kept going down to the city of Tama, where I had lived in Tama at the time, went to the fire station and all of the responders were there. They couldn't get out because there's no power to open up the doors. So I'd gotten in and the fire chief, he was standing there and he was just kind of looking around going, well, and everybody's going, where should we go first? What do we do? And he's like, I just don't know. I'm not sure. And I grabbed him by the shoulders and I said, where are you going first? What are we doing? And he's just like, and everybody's asking him questions. And I'm like, stop, let's take a breath. I said, we had literally just practiced their search routes for the city maybe a month before. I said, you guys have this, you know what to do, let's do it. And they all snapped to it. They went out and did it. I would say between both of those communities, 90 to 95% of the streets were blocked or impassable by trees that were down or fallen. I never did get a good number of how many homes were damaged and or destroyed. We had one home, and I believe that no one was in it, was absolutely crushed by a tree. It was just a really big old tree that had fallen and took out the entire house. There was a couple semis on each side of town that had blown over. Luckily, nobody was injured in those. After everything was said and done from that storm, we had one minor injury. A gentleman got a cut on the arm from broken glass. We had no deaths. I don't know how that happened, but we had no deaths, a couple minor injuries. But the hardest thing that we had to deal with was the loss of homes. People not understanding that they can't go back in their home because it is damaged and destroyed. Some people just lost everything and they thought, you know, I can't go back in there, so I'm just going to walk away from it. We had a lot of transients that worked at our packing plant that just left. That was hard because they were our population, they were our community members, and they just left. I could never track them down. It was very difficult. I had a few of my fellow emergency managers that were So the storm really did impact a lot of Iowa, but they weren't as impacted as we were in our county. He was kind of my mentor. He is still kind of my mentor. He is an emergency manager at a close by county. He came down that day and he asked me, "What are you going to do about self-care?" And I looked at him and said, "I can't focus on that today. I don't have the time. I have 17,000 people I have to focus on right now." And he goes, "You need to think about that because this is going to be over and you're not going to know what to do." I said, "Yeah, you're right." I said, "But right now I have to do damage assessments. I have people without homes. I don't know if they're going to need shelters. I'm going to need to feed people. There's a whole laundry list of things that I have to take care of. And I don't know how I'm going to get it done today." He goes, "Well, today all you've got to worry about is taking care of making sure, you know, life safety and things to that effect." And the one thing I forgot within the first couple hours was to take inventory of my own home. And at that point in time, I was dating a gentleman who actually lived in another town close by, who was a police sergeant down there. And I made contact with him. He was okay. But I forgot about my home and my dog. I have a beautiful German Shepherd that he's kind of my go-to guy when times are rough. He knows to come sit by me. He knows that, hey, Mindy's having a bad time. I just need to go, you know, let her lay her head on me and ruffle my fur. And I forgot about him. I still feel guilty to this day that I forgot about Cooper. And so finally it dawned on me that I need to go check my own home. I am not going to be any good to our community, our responders, or anybody else until I go check my own home. So it took me a trip home from my office usually took about, I don't know, 3 minutes, 5 minutes. That day it took me 45 minutes. I had to drive over curbs. I had to drive through yards. I had to drive over trees, debris, and I had to park about a mile away. And finally, after I walked over, through, around, under, I had to wait to verify that utility lines were off. I finally got home. As I'm trying to get there because I can't see anything because of all the trees, I finally took a sigh of relief and going, okay, my house is still standing. I still have a roof. I don't have power. My windows are still there. I'm missing some screens. I'm like, no big deal. And then I see my back doors open. And again, panic sets in. I'm like, okay, where's Cooper? He's a big, beautiful German Shepherd. So I'm hollering for him. My neighbors come over. They're like, "We haven't seen him." So I go in the house and he comes bounding around the corner and like leaps into my arms and just starts licking me all over the face. I'm like, okay, Cooper's fine. We can return back to work mode. So I clip a leash on him and we go. He thinks it's playtime. I'm like, no, we got to go. And he actually, for the time that he was with me at work, he really did serve as a service dog for people. He knew when people needed somebody to lean on or they were having a hard time, and he would walk over to them and just sit in front of them and let him pet them. So he, without any training, he did a great job for those responders, for community members. We really did make a great team because people would come in and they'd give me a list of damages. They'd come in and pick up food, supplies, whatever they needed. We talk about PTSD and things like that. I've lost a big chunk of post-derecho. I have a really solid hold on the day or so of the storm, but post that, I've lost a lot of memories. He did a great job, and he's helped me through a lot of that. But once we got through the initial response, I learned that there were no damages or no deaths. I took a big sigh and took a big step back and went, okay, this was devastating. This is devastating. We will recover from this. But, and this is going to sound weird to anybody that listens to it, that's maybe not a responder, it was a win for us because no one died. For me, if we lose somebody in an event, I take it personal and I really re-examine my job and think, is there something I could have done differently as a planner, as an emergency response personnel, as somebody who does outdoor warning or warnings or writes these things and says, how can I do it differently? What should I have done differently? So we have each community member goes home to a family member, or if they have to go to hospital for treatment, minor treatment. But if I lose a community member, I feel I didn't do my job in a thorough enough way.
Well, it sounds to me from listening to you tell this story that you absolutely did your job and you did it exceptionally well. And it sounds like Cooper did a great job too. I mean, you got to take your dog to work and he comforted people. For all the dog people listening, that's a big win. So I'm glad Cooper got a chance to help people probably just as much as you did that day, maybe in some ways even more. So what are some of the takeaways? What could you have done differently? What would you have done differently? What did you learn from this event in your current role and how do you apply it as you move forward?
Yeah. So since that storm, I've actually moved to a larger county. I now work in Black Hawk County, Iowa. So we're the fifth largest county in Iowa. And anyone I talk to, whether they have been a coordinator for longer than I have, I now have 10 years on, or they're a brand new coordinator, I always tell them to advocate for themselves and advocate for outdoor warning sirens and advocate for any type of mass notification systems. And also advocate for wind warnings. Wind can do just as much damage as a tornado can. So I have talked to my commission, since I'm governed by an emergency management commission, that we need to set off outdoor warning sirens for sustained warning winds over a threshold of 65 miles an hour. Because if a tree falls, you're outside, you happen to get smashed by a tree, you absolutely can die from that. So I have protocols and procedures in place that I can set off the outdoor warning sirens for sustained winds over 65 miles an hour. So for me, that's a win. That's a huge win. And if I were to do it again, if we were to have a derecho, I guess I should say when we have a derecho, not if we have a derecho again, I would absolutely hit that button again to set off the outdoor warning sirens. I would rather have, 133 people call me or 5 people call me and complain that they heard the outdoor warning sirens go off or they had their mass notification medium go off and wake them up because we had sustained winds of, 70 miles an hour and it woke them up and it saved one person rather than we didn't set it off and we had one person die from it.
I'd take that as well. Absolutely. Well, Mindy, thank you for being a guest on the podcast. I know you have another story to share with us, and I think we're going to be out of time today, but I hope you'll come back and share that story later on, because I really want to hear more about your work. And I'm glad we had an emergency manager on here finally. I think the work that you guys do is really important. It's really interesting, and it goes beyond that initial incident, but sometimes it lasts days, weeks, even months after the event, and that's really interesting stuff to hear about. So thank you for what you do, and thank you for being on the podcast, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you very much. Greatly appreciate it.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please take a minute and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcast platform you enjoy. Stories from the Road is a Brown Dogs Media Group production. This one-man show is written, edited, and produced by Phil Klein. Show notes are written by Jennifer Roeg. If you have a story you would like to share, please contact us at storiesfromtheroadpodcast@gmail.com. To learn more about this show, please visit storiesfromtheroadpodcast.com. Thank you for listening.